But ladies and gentlemen, let's kick off. Welcome to the Parliamentary Library, for those of you who don't work here. And today's lecture, Private Sector Whistleblowing, Options and Issues for Law Reform in Australia. I'm Jonathan Curtis, Assistant Secretary, Research Branch, again, for those who don't know me. Just a couple of opening comments on the topic. I'm very pleased to have Professor A.J. Brown talking about this one. I think in framing the topic, it's clear there's been a lot of discussion around public anti-corruption measures in particular over the last few years, and I think it's fair to say it's led to some quite significant improvements in the frameworks and protections in the Australian system, particularly Australia's capacity to detect and prosecute public sector corruption, both domestically and internationally. But I think a couple of things springs to mind. From my work in the area, it's pretty clear that whistleblowing is probably the single most effective way of discovering really ugly things going on inside an organisation. And secondly, the private sector, it seems to me, has been receiving relatively less attention compared to the public sector. But considering the amount of money that's flowing through the private sector, and of course the huge amount of public money that goes through the private sector through outsourcing and contracting out, I think it's certainly time for a look. It's a particularly good timing to have AJ talking on private sector whistleblowing. I'm delighted to welcome him. I think we've worked with each other on a few of my different jobs over the years. And I think I'd struggle to think of a better qualified person to talk about the subject. As Professor of Public Policy and Law at Griffith, he's a board member of Transparency International Australia, member of the International Whistleblowing Research Network, project leader of the Whistling While They Work 2, and of course one of the authors, if memory serves, of the Whistling While They Work 1, is that correct? And also some of the most detailed analysis of Australia's integrity system as a whole. So AJ will speak for about 30-35 minutes and we'll have some questions as usual, but please join me in welcoming AJ.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, and thank you all for taking some time out of your busy afternoon to participate in some discussion on this topic. It seemed like particularly good timing to come and speak with people about this topic due to the extent to which I think around Canberra and Parliament House and around the Commonwealth public sector, but especially in the Parliament, there's never been as much discussion, I think, about moving in this territory in terms of law reform as there has been in recent months. And so I thought it was, I'm very happy to accept the invitation to come and help equip those who might be grappling with some of these issues, whether you're advising. I'm tempted to just sort of ask where people are from, you can tell me afterwards. But within government ranks, within opposition ranks, within crossbench ranks, in PM&C, in Treasury, in multiple agencies, we know that this issue is alive and kicking. And I think given the sense or the extent to which there's now a sense of momentum towards seeing some law reform when it comes to corporate and private sector whistleblower protection in Australia, it seemed like a very good time to do my little bit to help share some thoughts about what's actually involved in taking on this issue seriously, which seems to be the direction that we're heading in. I probably don't need to talk at length about the significance of whistleblowing generally. I'll get more technical. But it's important to remember that a lot of the policy settings and dilemmas and the legislative design dilemmas that go with recognising the role of whistleblowing and whistleblower protection are partly about public integrity and anti-corruption, partly about public accountability, but also partly, if not largely, to some degree, always about people. And it always pays to remember that the individuals and the groups of people that we're talking about playing the role of being whistleblowers as part of our integrity systems. We can come back to specific cases, but I deal a lot in policy, in dry policy, generality, history, legislation. And it's also worth remembering that the question of whistleblower protection and legislative measures aimed at whistleblower protection in Australia have a long history, in relation to public sector whistleblower protection, but they also have a long history when it comes to private sector whistleblower protection. So I deliberately crammed all of this history onto one slide just to emphasise one of the main issues that I think is one of my objectives to put on the table this afternoon, which is that this is not simple. This has a history. This can be quite complex. It brings together many, many different strands of policy and legislation and law reform. And so for that reason, it's useful to think about, to actually take a step back and think about this history if you're involved in advising parliamentarians or the government or the crossbenchers or the opposition on what might be the solution to what are actually a range of issues that tend to travel together when it comes to talking about the role of whistleblower protection in our integrity systems. For all intents and purposes, the modern history, if you like, of talk about legislative reform to better protect whistleblowers in the corporate and private sectors dates from at least 1987, when the Gibbs Committee, when it was making its recommendations for reform of Commonwealth criminal law, emphasised the importance of whistleblower protection. This is at a time when whistleblower protection legislation was still at a relatively new phenomenon in the United States, which had generally led the charge out of the back of the Watergate era. Since then, there's been a continual sort of on-again, off-again discussion. But if you look at this history, you'll see that much of what is sort of delayed, if you like, but much of what has been the primary focus for reform in this area has been reforms that will lead to the protection of public sector whistleblowers, that being the first order of business for governments, generally speaking, over the last 20 or 30 years. So, for example, in 1994, when the first Senate Select Committee on Public Interest Whistleblowing reported, yes, it said that all employees, all insiders to organisations should have protections if they blow the whistle on wrongdoing, but the focus has been very much at both state level and Commonwealth level on sorting out public sector whistleblower protection for public sector employees first, and that's taken quite a long time in and of itself, as many people are aware. For the private sector, two things happened in the early 2000s, pretty much in the wake of the financial crisis before the last one. The collapse of companies like Enron and WorldCom in the US led to a whole suite of corporate law reform around transparency and disclosure that some people will remember. And as part of that, mirroring some parts of legislative reform in the US, corporate regulatory reform, the Corporations Act in Australia came to include, amongst other things, Part 9.4 AAA, which is the current set of private sector whistleblower protection provisions here in Australia. Much criticised, and rightly so. Almost since its inception, people recognised that this was a limited, fragmented and inadequate step, but nevertheless it was a step. And it's important to also note that along the way, about 5 years later, the Commonwealth Treasury did commence a review of those provisions, which was never actually fully completed for a variety of reasons that we needn't go into. But it means that we've sort of been coming around to a point where this issue was going to be back on the agenda and in a more powerful way. Along the way, the Commonwealth did manage to achieve its current public sector whistleblower protection legislation. As many of you would be aware, the Public Interest Disclosure Act in 2013. And it's also important to note that development when it comes to private sector whistleblowing for a couple of reasons. One is that it's a little known fact that all Commonwealth contractors, so all corporations, private employers who are Commonwealth contractors, are actually covered by the Commonwealth Public Interest Disclosure Act, and all their employees are all covered by the Public Interest Disclosure Act 2013. in relation to any of the different types of wrongdoing that are covered by that legislation, insofar as they relate to the service or the contract that's being performed. So I think it's actually probably would be a rude shock to many of the companies, that the many hundreds, if not thousands of companies that are Commonwealth contractors, that they are actually already covered by quite a comprehensive piece of whistleblower protection legislation. The other reason for mentioning it is that in recent years, in the context of a variety of very live current policy issues like integrity and regulation in the banking and finance sectors, just to name one, the Parliament has been giving much closer attention, and I'm sure there are people here who have been involved in this, especially through the Senate Economics Committee, much closer attention to the need for improvements in integrity regimes in a number of different sectors of the economy, but particularly the role of whistleblowing when it comes to the corporate world and to the private sector, and particularly prompted by its inquiries into financial planners and banking and all the circumstances that have also led us to the current or recent debates over a Royal Commission, and right up to last week when the CEOs of the banks were appearing in, was it in this building? And I assume it was in this building, and I was on a holiday. But the and we're talking about whistleblower protection as part of their integrity regimes. But the Senate Economics Committee actually, in its major recommendations in 2014 on this topic, it's quite detailed recommendations about the need for the Commonwealth to move to overhaul and replace the Corporations Act provisions, made specific reference to the fact that the Commonwealth should be looking again to the principles that form the basis of the 2013 Public Interest Disclosure Act, in order to not turn the clock back and move forward, but on the assumption, I think, that the principles behind that legislation should be used and would be relevant and should be relevant to the question of moving in on more comprehensive corporate and private sector whistleblower protection. That's an assumption, and it's a logical question as to whether, in fact, or the extent to which that is, in fact, correct. The things that have been happening even more recently than the Senate Economics Committee's very intensive interest in this topic are quite disparate. And I think one of the key messages that I wanted to leave you with today is that there is a real risk when an issue is manifesting itself in different debates, coming from different angles, popping up in different ways, there's always the risk that there will be piecemeal responses to those issues, or that people will incorrectly assume that because one issue has been solved, the whole issue has been solved when it comes to whistleblower protection. And my examples of this risk at the moment include a number of things. There's been an extensive debate about the role of rewards and incentives for whistleblowers, getting a cut of either the penalties or the fraud or the financial value recovered from a disclosure about wrongdoing, and with many references to the United States. This has quite a long history in and of itself. This year we've seen the first movement towards that actually manifesting itself in government policy in this year's budget and in the lead up to the United Kingdom Anti-Corruption Summit this year, where the government has announced, and I'm not aware of the details yet, if anyone wants to share any with me, I'd be happy to know them, where the government announced that it would introduce stronger incentives and protections for whistleblowers in the tax system, so people who blow the whistle that leads to the identification of tax revenues that need to be collected, that weren't otherwise being offered up, then we have a government policy decision yet to be implemented that will see whistleblower protection apparently strengthened in relation to that particular type of corporate malfeasance or regulatory breach. Whether or not that's going to translate into incentives and rewards, basically rewards for dobbing in companies that are not fulfilling their tax obligations, I'm not aware yet. But certainly in the United States and elsewhere, that's been a significant part of those reforms. So we see that idea of rewards and incentives leaping to the fore and becoming something much closer to policy reality here in Australia for the very first time. Certainly it's something that everybody wants to discuss. Greg Medcraft, the chairman of ASIC, for the last couple of years has actually been saying that we do need to look seriously at US-style rewards and incentives for whistleblowers, whistleblowers getting a cut of the proceeds because of its relative effectiveness in the United States as a mechanism for both facilitating but also for facilitating whistleblowing but also for giving whistleblowers some level of compensation that they may not otherwise be able to achieve. So that's one issue that's popped up, but very much linked to tax at the moment, rather than anything else in terms of any movement at a government level. There is the general movement towards increasing regulatory attention on the banking and finance sector, self-regulatory attention as well as external regulatory attention, and so there's been a lot of talk in that context about enhancing whistleblower protections. Of course, financial institutions are already covered. In addition to being covered by the Corporations Act provisions, they're already covered by some limited further protections of whistleblowers, criminal protections against victimisation, etc., in the Banking Act and in the legislation that APRA administers. So there's a logical question about, okay, well, what else do we need to do for that sector or the banking and finance sectors? And again, that's just one sector, though, of the economy. So we've got tax, something happening with tax over here. We've got a lot of attention going on with banking and finance over here. And at the same time as that, we have quite a lot of discussion happening about the need to do something else but related, which is to do something about the extent to which both public sector and private sector employees are at risk of prosecution for disclosing information that may be in the public interest to disclose as a result of a whole range of things that are happening in the public sector and the private sector and in the crossover in the not-for-profit sectors. So here I'm talking about the old problem, very old problem, since 1914 indeed, problem of Section 70 of the Crimes Act and the fact that the prohibition on officials on Commonwealth public officials from disclosing any information has been subject to a very draconian criminal provision since that time, which is well overdue for reform. The reason why that's so significant now, because that issue's been kicking around for quite a long time, is that it's received new attention thanks to, particularly since the creation of the Australian Border Force and its legislation, and concerns about contracted out officials, especially health professionals and mental health professionals working in the immigration detention system, people are aware of this, being subject themselves subject to an extension of effectively an extension of the Section 70 provisions. This is not a new development, but it's a contemporary manifestation of the problem that we've got about having such a draconian piece of secrecy legislation. It's played out even more recently and even more dramatically and even more politically in the context of the investigations into the disclosures by the NBN co-employees to the opposition in the lead-up to the election. And as I understand it, the Nick Xenophon team is committed publicly to introducing legislation to create or to recognise a public interest defence to prosecutions for disclosure in circumstances such as the NBN Co. disclosures, but also others. It's broader than just any one of these particular contexts. So the reason why that's significant is that very often people say, well, that's protecting whistleblowers, and it may be, but all of these different things going on highlight some of the complexities of this issue, because I, for one, am not in a position to stand up here today and say that the employees who disclosed information about the operations of NBN Co. were necessarily disclosing information that related to wrongdoing in the sense that whistleblower protection legislation is typically oriented towards. They may have been disclosing information that, in the full light of day, should entitle them to a public interest defence if they were prosecuted, depending on what that information is and that may well be something that a magistrate or a court should be entitled to consider, which our law doesn't currently allow for, but they may or may not be whistleblowers, depending on exactly how we define that term. There's a real risk that if people think that a rewards and incentives scheme is in place for corporate whistleblowers, that therefore that's all that's needed and that there's no need for any other type of protection because whistleblowers will avail themselves of that means of getting compensation, for example, for damage to their career. That's not a correct assumption. There's always been an assumption that if you put in place shield laws for journalists that mean that journalists are protected from having to reveal their sources in court, and those sources are whistleblowers, then that protects whistleblowers. But we've had that debate before, and we'll probably have to have it again to point out that no, actually that protects journalists from being prosecuted. It only indirectly in some ways may protect some whistleblowers, but in fact there are situations now where journalists are protected but whistleblowers aren't protected for going to those journalists and revealing that information. So it's actually important to, from a policy perspective, to put all of these issues into their proper perspective before we go too much further down the track of considering how the various recommendations and commitments to implement stronger, more comprehensive corporate whistleblower protection are actually implemented. And I should mention just at the bottom in terms of this history as well that there's never been a better time for government to move on this issue, not only because of the momentum behind all these various issues and this history, but because we're about to hopefully see the release of the first draft National Action Plan under Australia's commitment to the International Open Government Partnership. And certainly whistleblower protection is one of the many issues that form the suite of issues under the priorities that that open government partnership commitments are attuned to. So that provides a great opportunity for the Australian government to move on this issue, in addition to its commitments under the G20 anti-corruption action plans and various other commitments that it's made. Over the next few years, Transparency International Australia and various academic colleagues will be conducting the next National Integrity System Assessment of Australia as well, which is another opportunity to try and help find the solutions to some of these vexed policy issues that have been cooking away in a whole variety of forms, as you can see, for quite a long period of time. I mentioned before that it's important to actually have a clear idea about what a whistleblower is for the purposes of law reform in this territory. I won't give you a blow-by-blow. Certainly you'll be welcome to this presentation, and there's a reference on there. But it's important to recognise that sometimes, when I'm talking about whistleblowing here today, I'm talking about insiders to organisations, typically employees, but they may be contractors, they may be volunteers, but typically insiders to organisations. And blowing the whistle on wrongdoing, which affects more than just themselves, that actually has a public interest dimension to it. And that's why on this diagram, that's whistleblowers sort of fall into the bottom left quadrant of those spectrums. Insiders and outsiders, interested outsiders, wrongdoing that affects individuals through to wrongdoing that affects most or all of society. But you can see there are lots of other different types of informants, complainants, witnesses, that are and should be entitled to different levels of legal protection for having made their complaint or provided their information or played their role as witnesses. And we need to be very clear. For example, probably half the people that a tax whistleblowing scheme is aimed at are not necessarily the insiders to the companies. They may be tax advisors who sit out here somewhere, or they may be competitors or rivals who get access to good information, or suppliers that may be sitting out here somewhere. And so we have to be clear about who we're trying to protect in what way and why, with what. And that's really the next crucial issue, because from a law reform point of view, one of the great complexities of whistleblowing is that it actually sits at the conjunction and the interface of a whole variety of different types of law that don't normally come together in the way that they do when it comes to the vexed issue of whistleblowing. And this little diagram by a very fine scholar from Washington, D.C., actually sort of sets it out quite nicely. When you look at the different types of rights and different types of interests that are motivating whistleblower protection, it actually leads to there being four different types of law all coming together. Human rights protection, the right to free speech. Employment protection, the right to fair treatment in the workplace by your employer when you disclose wrongdoing that is in the company's interests or fellow employees' interests to have disclosed and dealt with. Open government and market regulation. A lot of what we're talking about here today is about, well, how do we actually make sure that the information about regulatory breaches and failures by companies in their duties towards society, their shareholders, employees, etc., comes to light. All of these things come together when we're talking about whistleblower protection. So, accordingly, there are actually different models, different conceptual models that inform different strands of existing whistleblower protection legislation around the world that are informed by those different legal perspectives, depending on where people have started from. And only very rarely, in any comprehensive way, does anybody sit back and actually think it through to design something that isn't ad hoc and piecemeal. Which is why whenever there's a new law reform opportunity, such as Australia has now, it's an opportunity to actually do something better than anybody has done before. And I'll put it to you that there are some special reasons why everybody who's got an influence on this, why it's in our interest to actually seize that opportunity. As a snapshot, just so that you know where we stand, these two charts that I'll show you now are from the recent reviews of the whistleblower protection laws of G20 countries that an international team that I've been involved in have been conducting for a couple of years. This is the public sector. This is the public sector whistleblower protection. You don't need to know. These are the G20 countries, and Australia actually sits down the right-hand end once we got the Commonwealth Public Interest Disclosure Act into place. Because compared to the rest of the G20, we're relatively sophisticated when it comes to the comprehensiveness of those regimes at a federal and state level. That doesn't mean that we're by any means perfect, however, and in fact you can say that we're the best of a pretty mediocre bunch in many ways. Because when you go state by state or jurisdiction by jurisdiction, just for the public sector, then there's a degree to which in many jurisdictions some of the key elements are either weak or missing that you would expect. And I'm happy to walk through those in a little bit more detail. To the extent that in South Australia, which is the most recent and current reform proposal, there's a bill in the South Australian Parliament at the moment, so that's the one at the top there. They're actually replacing their 1993 legislation, which was the first in Australia, with something which is, in some respects, a bit retrograde on that legislation, and certainly not taking full advantage of the lessons from other jurisdictions to really move to the front of the pack. So there are problems with our public sector whistleblower protection legislation around the country that have to be borne in mind. This idea that we just roll over what we know from the public sector whistleblower protection legislation into the private sector is a fairly dangerous sort of idea when it comes to law reform and legislative design. When it comes to the private sector, we're sitting very low in the pack amongst the G20, and this is part of why I think the momentum towards dealing with what is effectively, to a large degree, a big gap in Australia caused by the very limited nature of the Corporations Act provisions is something that is well overdue for us to really deal with comprehensively now as a result of all of these different stimuli and initiatives that are finally catching up with us. So I just thought I would run through very quickly, or leave you with, eight key issues that I think are crucial to the design of what government and what the Parliament does when it comes to corporate whistleblower protection legislation. And then I'm happy to answer questions about specifics of these or to talk more with people afterwards. The first is the very basic question that I've already flagged about whether we're going to do this piecemeal or whether we're going to do it comprehensively. Are we just going to fiddle with the Corporations Act, which only applies to breaches of corporations law, whatever that means? And there are some very interesting and diverse interpretations of what that may mean that are kicking around in this town, to my knowledge, from almost nothing to almost anything. and or are we going to do something comprehensive? And the most important fact for you to take away and propagate to all your policy colleagues is that if we don't make the decision to do something comprehensive and overarching for the private sector that applies to all employers, that covers all areas of Commonwealth regulation and preferably all areas of regulation altogether, we're going to end up going down the US route where they have 47 different pieces of federal regulatory legislation, all with whistleblower protection provisions applying in the private sector. That's the default of what happens from a piecemeal approach. So we're in a position now where we can avoid going down that path, which puts us in a great position, but we've actually got to recognise the imperative of that fundamental decision right from the word go. What areas of regulation go into this approach is an obvious question, and we could talk about that. One of the significant problems about it is that we're still a federal system in which the states actually regulate various parts of business activity and life to a significant degree as well. So we have to think about this in terms of the federal design of the regime if we're operating from the point of view of trying to make whatever the regulatory approach is as simple and efficient for business as we can, which is one of my assumptions and starting points. What types of wrongdoing is a really significant question because of the fact that, unlike the public sector, where we can identify almost anything that a public servant wants to speak up about as being potentially wrong is something that, because it affects the public sector and public integrity, there's a legitimate reason why protection should flow, etc. For the private sector, it's a little bit more complex. Some of the types of competitive behaviour that we would regard as being inimical to the public sector are in fact a presumption on which the private economy is built and capitalism thrives. So we actually have to recognise that breaches of law, breaches of compliance, regulatory requirements, etc., are clearly sort of in terms of types of wrongdoing that should trigger whistleblower protection for employees in the private sector. But the problem is that we can't limit it to that because we know that in many industries, in many companies, if not all, there is either a written or unwritten code of the types of behaviour, the types of conduct that are in our context are things that we expect our employees to report to us or, if necessary, to a regulator, preferably to us first. And that protection should flow for those things and that many of them will not be legal breaches. They'll be unethical practices or breaches of clients' interests or the beginning of the slippery slope in terms of unethical or undesirable practices that fall well short of any criminal or legal breach threshold. But those types of wrongdoing, which is going to be so diverse across the entirety of the economy, have to be able to be captured by a comprehensive whistleblower protection regime. So we haven't yet had the debate. We need to have the debate about, okay, how are we going to draw these new parameters so that we actually get the right balance that we want. Should organisations, should employers be subject to mandatory procedures or subject to other incentives to have procedures that mean that they put in place whistleblower protection systems within their own ranks? And obviously we're not talking about necessarily every kind of tiny small business here, but we are certainly talking about a significant large proportion of the private sector. And this is a really big issue because we know from overseas experience that this is where many of the, even the leading edge whistleblower protection regimes in the US and certainly even in the UK are falling down. This is the weak point. It's one thing to put in place various types of legal protection for employees, but it's another thing to actually stimulate or require employers to get on the front foot and not mishandle whistleblowing, not sweep things under the carpet, not hang whistleblower out to dry or subject them to reprisals or just sack them instantly. All these things require a slightly different mindset, which requires a proactive approach. And in Australia, we're very strong in the public sector on having that approach now quite well institutionalised, increasingly so. The question is, how is that going to be achieved for the private sector? So we do have a now out-of-date, in fact officially withdrawn, Australian standard for whistleblower protection programs. which has been in place since 2003, just before the Clerk 9 reforms. But it's very limited, and formally it's been withdrawn by Standards Australia as being out of date. As part of our current research, we hope to see the drafting and the promulgation of a new replacement Australia and New Zealand standard. So it is possible to give guidance on what whistleblower protection programs, what internal disclosure procedures might look like, what best practice is. And the research project that Jonathan mentioned, Whistling While They Work Too, which is currently underway, supported by an Australian Research Council linkage project and involving ASIC, the Commonwealth Ombudsman's Office, and about 22 other partner organisations nationally and in New Zealand, is looking squarely at a far more comprehensive piece of research than has ever been attempted before, to actually start really documenting, well, what is current practice, best practice, effective practice, in a way that can support a lot of this type of reform. On the 8th of November, we'll release the results from the first wave, the first initial survey, which will have new data on 702 Australian organisations from the public sector, the private sector and the not-for-profit sectors, which in and of itself is an unprecedented body of knowledge, which we'll be releasing in a few weeks, which is just the first cut on what's the current state of play as far as we can tell in terms of those sorts of systems and procedures. Certainly for a lot of organisations, there is nothing foreign about this. They're crying, public sector and private sector employers are crying out for better guidance on, okay, well, just tell us what to do and we will do it, or at least we'll adapt it. The question of procedures for those organisations, guidance, but also mandatory procedures or procedures that they can be incentivised to introduce is a critical part of the reform package. It's not something where you just leave it up to a free-for-all as to how all of this actually gets implemented. So back to the list, and then the final four things really relate to how we implement any kind of regime. Given we're talking about employment protection, how does this interface with the Fair Work Act and with employee protection and workplace relations laws generally? And that's a huge issue in and of itself. It's been broached by the Commonwealth Public Interest Disclosure Act 2013 because it was the first legislation to actually squarely say, okay, there are employment remedies for employees relate to this whole question. And the UK legislation is built on that presumption right from the word go. So there's a whole conjunction there. This is not just about open government, this is about employment law as well. This is about regulatory practice as well. And then there are a range of other questions in terms of how you actually make sure that these various types of whistleblower protection, rights to compensation, rights to remedies, and implementation of these regimes and schemes can be made effective. And I'm happy to answer questions about those. Then finally, there's the question about what sort of process is going to be needed for reform. And I think this is a question where there hasn't been much discussion yet about, okay, if the government and the parliament, whether as a result of private members' initiatives or whether as a result of government policy decision or the acceptance of recommendations of the Senate Economics Committee, whatever the path is that is about to see us start commencing the serious process of policy design and decision and legislative design that will deal with this issue, how are we going to do it? It was relatively easy with the Public Interest Disclosure Act 2013 for a parliamentary committee, the Standing Committee on Legal and Constitutional Affairs in the House of Reps, to do a very good inquiry that was led by backbencher Mark Dreyfus that succeeded largely in getting in place the policy process that led to that legislation. Because we had the previous public sector whistleblowing regimes at a state level to draw upon, a lot of history and a lot of thought had already gone into it. Less so for this much more complex problem of the private sector. We've got a COAG dimension, a state, federal, some federal dimensions that you don't have with the public sector. There are technical questions about how these different bodies of law should come together for the private sector, which are different and which need expert input and serious consideration of the options based on research. And you've got some pretty powerful and significant stakeholders that run right throughout the economy. Business, unions, employees, in addition to do-gooding NGOs like Transparency International Australia or do-gooding academics like me. So we actually need to be thinking about a serious process that brings this outside of what would be a minimalist public policy process for developing a response to these issues. And so that's my, I've gone slightly over, but still at least I've left a little bit of time for questions. That's my snapshot. Eight quite complex issues and some big questions about process. And so I deliberately didn't come today armed with all the answers because I think we're at the stage where it's much more important that we map the issues. As it's long been said, if you can get the question right and the process right, then I'm still one of these naive, idealistic people in public policy land that believes that actually you can make good public policy and good decisions and end up with quite good legislation. So as long as we're clinging to that ideal, then it's simply more important to recognise the questions that we need to be building into where government and the parliament takes these issues from now. So thank you very much, John.
Thank you very much, Andrew. So we've got a bit of time for questions. Any questions to kick off?
Thanks very much. Can you comment on how the changing nature of employment might affect whistleblowing legislation, so the gig economy or freelancing, that kind of casualisation?
Yeah, certainly. I think it's a complex problem that we're still figuring out how to deal with, generally speaking, in the same way that the rest of employment law often is. But if I just go back to this question of how best to use employment law remedies and systems, including the Fair Work Act, as one of the answers to that, it's actually recognising that the responsibility to act on and protect and support whistleblowers and to act on their disclosures actually goes with the workplace. It actually goes with the fact that people are in that organisation, not necessarily legally, but physically or socially or economically. That's what puts them inside the organisation, that gets them access to the information and which exposes them to the risks of reprisals which would otherwise lead to them not disclosing that information. And so it's a little bit like workplace health and safety law being extended to whoever is in this place is covered, you know. And really, that's a key for most policymakers, I think, in dealing with whistleblowing. That's a bit of a revelation still here in Australia, because we're coming at it from an open government perspective or a regulation perspective, and we're not coming at it from a workplace health and safety perspective, which is in fact to a large degree what it really is. So that's the single largest part of the answer. But the other is the fact that, the Commonwealth Public Interest Disclosure Act, that the legislation can be designed to cover not just employees, but contractors, employees of contractors, volunteers, effectively anybody who is in the workplace. So you can come at it from both angles.
I've got one while others are thinking. Most regulatory systems have the inherent risk of creating perverse incentives where you tackle a problem with one measure only to displace it and create another one. In the remedies you can put in place for whistleblower protection, are you aware of any perverse incentives that policymakers need to be aware of or alive to and avoid creating?
I think the most obvious and most feared perverse incentive is sort of litigation culture and complaint culture, and the fact that there will always be a certain proportion of employees who will game any system and will try and use any system often quite sort of legitimately from their own perspective, will try and use something like a whistleblower protection regime as a forum through which to pursue other types of grievances. So that the attempt to deal with the problem becomes something cumbersome and costly in its own right. And I think that's probably the single greatest, traditionally probably there's been the single greatest fear in the public sector, that we'll end up with lots of vexatious complaints or people pursuing employment related grievances, trying to use these different whistleblower protection regimes to try and protect themselves, etc. But we know from the public sector experience that those risks are manageable, and part of our research is, which is why the regulatory agencies and the public integrity agencies are such valued partners of ours, is trying to identify the tricky ways, or not tricky, but the sophisticated ways of how to design these systems in with other workplace grievance systems in order to that they can operate efficiently. But it's a different question for the private sector how that would operate. So I think we have to remember that the odds are tipped so heavily against the average employee or even the average senior employee when it comes to the power of organisations versus their employees in terms of the power differentials, that there are valid reasons why this is all geared towards recognising that the average employee starts off at a disadvantage when it comes to any of these situations, rather than being in a situation where they can call the shots and incur enormous costs for organisations, etc., etc. What I think the biggest risk for organisations is the lesson which many organisations learn quite quickly, which is that if they respond sensibly and proactively and quickly to allegations of wrongdoing or disclosures of wrongdoing internally and get onto them and disclose proactively, then the whole process can be managed much better, just as it's true with other types of employment disputes and grievances. And so it tends to be organisations that haven't learnt that lesson that fear that the most, that this is going to open some sort of floodgate that's inefficient for us to have to manage. But apart from that, I think one of the good things about the recognition of the role of whistleblower in public integrity and in good regulatory regimes is that it actually should work most of the time as really a win-win for everybody, because it's in organisations' interest to know when their employees or other insiders suspect or actually know that there's some significant type of wrongdoing. It's obviously in the interest of the employees to have strong protection mechanisms in place. It's in the interest of regulators and the broader society to know that these issues are being dealt with either by the organisation in the first instance, hopefully without any hullabaloo, but if that's not possible, then with regulators getting involved as quickly and efficiently as possible, and our regulators seem to be learning how to get involved much more quickly and efficiently than perhaps they have traditionally, and whistleblowers have been part of that process. So it's actually, from a broad public policy point of view, this doesn't all have to end in tears. The problem is that it's so complex and that the power imbalances are so great that actually making whistleblower protection real really does require some serious investment.
One here and then maybe a short one and perhaps a longer one. Are you aware of any cases that have been brought to the Federal Court or to the Fair Work Commission involving PID?
No. The recent review conducted by Philip Moss into the first 3 years of the, really only 2 years, into the PID Act 2013 didn't come up with any either. In some ways that's not surprising because you would expect some time to pass before any significant number of cases might manifest. The fact that no cases have been identified as manifesting yet is probably an indicator of what is really captured by this slide here, which is that when it comes to remedies, which is what we're talking about here, avenues for compensation through courts or tribunals, the remedies that the Commonwealth copied off the states, my code here is NKTW, which means not known to work. So there are some unique things about the Commonwealth regime in terms of costs provisions, which are more progressive, more pro the whistleblower than anything in the state regimes, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're as good as they could be. And I think this is ultimately part of our research is intended to try and identify, okay, to what extent is there a need for these remedies to be being delivered? We know there is a need, but what's the extent of it? relative to the basically complete lack of delivery of those remedies through these types of avenues.
Which goes to the second part of the question, the proposition I put to you is that when a whistleblower feels he's been wrong and probably is out of a job and seeks a remedy in the court, my understanding of PID legislation, he won't get costs awarded against him, but he has to pay his legal fees, not only for the first case, but for the second case where the Commonwealth appeals and appeals again, and it just, you know, it's an impossible a task for someone to do that. They run out of money in the first instance.
I mean, it is. Yeah, quite. And neither does the typical employer in the private sector, who may well be even more cashed up than the Commonwealth for the purpose, when it comes to legal resources, etc., and insurance. And, so that's really goes to some of the key questions about how do we make this real? How do we make these remedies actually accessible? And I think that there are some new interesting innovations to be thought about making that real. In the Commonwealth sphere, under the PID Act, in fact, you can recover your costs if you're successful. But if you're not successful, you've still got to cover your own costs, but at least you're not exposed to the Commonwealth's costs, unless it's been vexatious.
Because the lawyer will expect payment all the way through to the last appeal.
So, which is why this little... one of my bright ideas currently, which I'm always tentative about a bright idea, you know, till it's been exposed and scrutinised. But one new potentially bright idea is that perhaps more important than having a reward scheme that means that whistleblowers get the cut of the fraud or the penalty, but that whistleblower gets the cut, that we make it a really big cut and that the whistleblower can get, in those circumstances, can get some of that cut. But a large part of that cut actually goes into effectively a fund, like a legal aid type system that is specifically for these types of cases because of that problem. Because legal aid, you know, well, we all know legal aid is not as much of it as there used to be, even if it would apply to these situations. So there's actually some things we can do building on previous precedents to actually move seriously on those very, very real issues. And I constantly spend a lot of time trying to explain to parliamentarians that, okay, well, this will be relatively, then they say, this will be relatively simple. We'll just copy what the states have done. And it's taken a while for me to make them aware that what the states have done has not necessarily worked, and therefore we've actually got to be thinking about doing something better. And that's really the bottom line, is that it can be worse than useless to have legislation which symbolically offers all these protections, but which in reality doesn't.
Would you think that UK PID Act could be a good time to pass trial reform?
The UK PID Act is something we need to look at really closely, and which actually was looked at least to some degree in the 2013 PID Act. And that's why there's a special mention of it there when it comes to... It's actually the UK PID provisions aren't a piece of standalone legislation. They're embedded in the Employment Relations Act. So they apply to public sector employers and private sector employers, although there's some big public sector entities like the police and the military and that are carved out. So we're one step ahead on that front, largely. But the... But certainly covers all private sector employers. There's other limitations. All of the UK provisions do is offer a compensation mechanism through the Employment Relations Tribunal system. It doesn't do anything else. And there's a big problem with confidentiality agreements and at the moment, and just people bypassing and escaping the requirements of the system, amongst other things. But there's no requirement for mandatory procedures. There's no regulatory effect of the legislation. If organisations don't get the message that they could be liable for this compensation, then they're likely to just keep on repeating the same mistakes that every other employer has made before. So there's there are limitations to the UK regime, but certainly it was a small revolution in terms of some of the simple fundamentals of that regime. So we've certainly got a lot to learn from the UK regime.
Kind of like a combination between the Australian PID and UK PID?
Yes, but we've always got to remember we're a federal country still. So that's why we've still got to navigate that. You know, that's where the UK has the beauty of being a unitary country. So we've still got some complexities about being a federal country, and as well as dealing with the things that the UK PID provisions don't do. There's nothing in the world that we can just take off the shelf. This is the big problem. Nothing. In fact, we wrote, you know, Australian jurisdictions at the public sector level were innovating with whistleblower protection legislation far before most of the rest of the world. So we've actually got to, that's why it's such a serious but interesting design issue where, from a policy and a legislative design point of view, we really can lead the world.
Exercise moderation's privilege and ask a second one. Most of the discussion seems to be around the banking and finance sort of sectors. Are there any other kind of industry sectors that you think are sleepers that where the, you know, the next big scandal could break but haven't really been on the radar much?
Well, I think
you'd like to speculate.
Yeah. I mean, I think the short answer is almost any. You know, depending on what's going on at the time. It's all the more reason why we should be taking a comprehensive approach, because there's no limit to, you know, history says, especially if you look internationally, there's no limit to, there's often no way of predicting where the big problems are. I mean, certainly in one of the reasons why the OECD Working Group on Foreign Bribery has been emphasising whistleblower protection and highlighting Australia's deficiencies in when it's been doing reviews of our implementation of the OECD Convention on Foreign Bribery is because that's an area where economies like Australia's are increasingly exposed to the risks and the pitfalls of foreign bribery, as we've seen, and as a couple of our whistleblowers in the first slide, Brian Hood and James Shelton, demonstrate from Note Printing Australia and Sir Currency Limited, that whistleblowers, you know, can and should play a pivotal role in helping companies avoid the pitfalls of having the risks of getting caught up in foreign corrupt practices manifest themselves upon them. But but nobody ever sees these things coming. I mean, it can be workplace health and safety. In Bangladesh, it's faulty building approvals causing garment factories to fall down. In the UK or in Holland or whatever, it's people leaving the bow doors open on on vehicle and passenger ferries crossing the North Sea. There's, you know, all the range of areas in any industry where there is a risk of anything from fraud and corruption through to risks of the environment or public health and safety. You know, it's just always context dependent. So I think that's part of the reason why a system which actually operates across all of those risks, across all of those areas of regulation, all those areas of corporate life, becomes in the end simpler and more efficient than regulating industry by industry based on, you know, a particular assessment that, okay, we've got problems in this industry, we've got problems in that industry. And law enforcement officials and regulatory officials will tell you that too, because, you know, everyone knows about displacement, you know, problems. Just because they're solved over here, in fact, only increases the chances that they're going to manifest over here, doesn't it? Yeah. So that's the happy land, happy world that we live in.
All right, I think that's no more questions. So on that happy note, ask you to join me in thanking AJ again for coming all the way from Brisbane on holiday. thank you very much, AJ. Great to see you.
Yes. Oh, hi. Hey, yeah. Not really.